From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really shouldn't miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. Coming up, President Trump's most high-profile booster in Massachusetts has been State Representative Jeff Diehl. And more than a month into the new administration, he's still on board.
When new presidents come into office, there's always a hiccup or two, and I think that's really nothing major.
This may shock you, but he thinks the media deserves some blame for that. Then, tourism officials in the Pioneer Valley got together and said they weren't big fans of the name Pioneer Valley. So they hired a consultant, and the result? West Mass. We hear defense of the much-mocked rebranding.
The misnomer there is that people can't call it Pioneer Valley anymore. And that's just not the truth.
Well, that's good. Otherwise, you know, we'd have a lot of buses that need new paint jobs. Then, our Facing Change series continues with a story about a Vietnam refugee who grew up in Hartford and recently bought a house in the Pioneer Valley.
Storytelling can make this happen, where we can recognize one another.
Ocean Vong is using poetry to make his refugee experience universal. All that and more just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, in the small Franklin County town of Conway, cleanup continues after a tornado wreaked havoc Saturday night, blowing roofs off and wrapping metal roofing material around trees. New England Public Radio's Carrie Healy went there and filed this report, which aired on Monday.
Only one person was reported injured in the storm. Six properties were very badly damaged in the Pumpkin Hollow area of town. One house is now missing its side walls. You can see the inside perfectly, like a dollhouse. This morning, Suzanne Artemiev was out walking her dogs on top of debris all over the sidewalk and road. She says she wasn't home when the tornado hit, with wind speeds forecasters say were between 100 and 110 miles an hour. But she figured something had happened when, later that night, she couldn't drive back into town.
The roads were totally impassable. It was like a mountain of trees and wires.
Artemiev needed to get home to give medication to one of her dogs, so she left her car and walked the rest of the way home. Today, heavy machinery and work crews are busy removing trees from roofs and beginning the process of cleanup. Acting Town Administrator Patricia Vincasey says the town has had a lot of help from the state and nearby towns.
Now we're in recovery mode, focusing on debris removal and getting back to normal as much as we can.
John Maggs lives in Pumpkin Hollow next to the Old Town Common. His barn long ago held cows and more recently used for storage was flattened by the tornado.
We're not going to restore the barn. It's impossible. It would take more means than we have.
Overlooking the cleanup activity on Academy Hill Road, I met Lynn Bosman, who was out early this morning collecting eggs from her small flock of chickens.
Well, you know, I was sitting right inside those windows right there, and of course the wind was on this side of the house. And I was thinking about the trees that were over the chicken coop and the chickens, and I was wondering if they would keep laying for us the next day. I thought they'd be disturbed, but...
They weren't. But on the other side of the coop?
Friends' homes. It's where we walk almost every day. It's where we walked our kids when they were in strollers. It's where they run and play now on the old common that probably won't have a tree left standing at the end of it. But, you know, that's all very small when you consider people's homes are destroyed.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's incomprehensible that that would be in Conway, that that would happen in February.
A highly unusual occurrence is what the National Weather Service called it. The agency said there has never been a tornado in Massachusetts in February since at least 1950, when it started keeping track of these things. On Saturday night, the storm picked up, and Bosman decided she better join her husband and kids downstairs.
And I was starting to walk down to the basement, and I just saw a bright flash of light, which was that transformer coming down over 116, or into the house on 116. We had no clue until the next morning what had happened.
Down the hill and across the ball field in Pumpkin Hollow, Kurt Schwartz was taking pictures and making notes.
We were on the ground, you know, Saturday evening once there were initial reports of significant damage.
Schwartz is the director of the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency.
We'll leave when the town doesn't need help anymore, whether that's one day or 2 weeks.
There is stability here. Power is back on in much of town. Much of the 30 roads that were once impassable are now cleared. The fire chief says by tonight they hope to lift the town's state of emergency, getting closer to normal for many, though certainly not all, of the fewer than 2,000 residents of Conway. For New England Public Radio, I'm Carrie Healy.
There's no one in Massachusetts more in President Donald Trump's corner than State Representative Jeff Deal. The Republican from Whitman was the only state elected official to endorse Trump. Now that the new administration is more than a month old, New England Public Radio's Susan Kaplan checked in with Deal and asked him to grade the president's early moves.
Well, I think the first thing he did was prioritize every promise he had made on the campaign trail and began with doing executive orders as well as hiring the secretaries or nominating the secretaries he was looking for to make the transition. And, of course, that's been a little bit of a difficult process because the Democrats, it seems, headed by Elizabeth Warren, are trying to block just about every nominee, it seems, as well as any and all of the initiatives that he's been working on.
What's your biggest disappointment from the first few weeks? Are there any policy moves, for example, that you disagree with?
No, I think, again, everything that he did, whether it was the immigration ban from seven countries or it was the effort to get Obamacare repealed, and I know that's moving along in the House. They have a version coming out next week. I think all those things were every single promise he had made on the campaign trail, and he sort of ticked them off one by one. So other than maybe a misstep here or there or a nominee that may not have worked out, which I think is normal given just about any presidential takeover, those are just bumps in the road that are normal.
So in your experience, the way in which the, for example, as you mentioned, the executive order that barred immigrants from coming from these seven countries and the way that that happened and resulted in a judicial action, you're saying that's just what all presidents go through in the beginning?
When new presidents come into office, there's always a hiccup or two, and I think that's really nothing major. I mean, if anything, it might just be that the media is overblowing the fact that there is a learning curve as to how orders should be issued and maybe the vetting process through them. But I don't think it's anything that should be alarming or anything that was unexpected from his campaign promises.
Governor Charlie Baker regularly splits with Trump, a fellow Republican. Is the governor making a mistake? Do you worry it'll hurt Massachusetts' clout with the new administration?
Well, I think Governor Baker has clearly decided that there is a, an audience in Massachusetts that supports him and didn't support Donald Trump, and I don't blame him for doing what's politically expedient. You know, as for how it affects Massachusetts down the road, of course, I want to do my best to be a liaison within the legislature and helping the governor's office work with the Trump administration. But I think that at the end of the day, Donald Trump isn't going to punish any one state or any one governor for what happened on the campaign trail. I think that Massachusetts has always proven important as a leader in education and health care. I think the Trump administration is going to realize that working with Massachusetts even more in the future is in his best interest, regardless of electoral count.
An article in the Boston Herald says that you've been approached by national Republicans to possibly run against Democrat Senator Elizabeth Warren in 2018. Who were you contacted by, and what did they say to try to convince you to run?
Well, of course, I need to keep people who spoke to me off the record. But what they've talked about is the fact that it's very clear that Elizabeth Warren is the voice of obstruction in Washington, D.C. We had an election that was clearly a change election from the way business is done. And I think that what people want to see is someone who is working for the state here in Massachusetts. And that's evidenced by a recent poll that shows that 46% of the people of Massachusetts would prefer to see a different senator. And that's before anybody's even announced running against her. And I think that it's time in Massachusetts for a voice for the people of the state rather than somebody who's positioning, it seems, to run in 2020 against the president.
That's State Representative Jeff Deal. We've also requested an interview with Senator Warren. We've actually long requested an interview with Senator Warren. We'll see if it pans out this time. For decades, the three counties of Massachusetts along the Connecticut River, Franklin, Hampshire, and Hampden, have been collectively known as the Pioneer Valley. But some boosters of the region decided the moniker is old-fashioned and confusing. So the Greater Springfield Convention and Visitors Bureau and Economic Development Council of Western Massachusetts spent $80,000 to hire a consultant from Oklahoma to rebrand this region. West Mass was launched with a two-minute video.
You never know what you're going to see
in the 413.
You never know what you're going to see
in the 413.
That video and the brand have been met with criticism and mockery on social media. To hear a defense of West Mass, New England Public Radio's Henry Epp sat down with Greg Chico. He's the director of sales for the Big E and a board member of the Visitors Bureau. Henry asked him why the new brand is necessary.
Well, first of all, a couple of things. Let's go through the process that we went through. There were 70-some-odd proposals that were placed out into the marketplace, both locally and nationally. 23 of those came back. We selected six or seven, three of which were locals. And ultimately
This is proposals for the consultant.
Selection of the consultant, exactly. And inevitably, we found a consultant that was out of market, that specialized in exactly what we were looking for, and that is rebranding. And their concept was to come in, learn as much as they possibly can about the region, and then basically tell us what we are. And so, the stakeholders were the general public. There were surveys on Mass Live, the business community, the tourism community. And ultimately, if you see the one-hour presentation, it makes a lot more sense than just simply saying, okay, West Mass, because it sounds very simplified. But, the whole concept of Pioneer Valley, we all embrace. I mean, I've lived here my entire life. There's businesses called Pioneer Valley. Mm-hmm. But the reality is it doesn't resonate with people that are not from here. People, when asked outside of market, what do you think about Pioneer Valley, they think we're someplace in the Midwest with covered wagons. That's the impression they get out of it. So our whole idea was to modernize, to contemporize, and more importantly, to showcase all the innovations that are going on here. This is a rebrand that needs to get out to the public outside of the region to attract people to come here.
Well, so far the reaction within the region, there's been some negative reaction. There's an online petition signed by over 700 people as we're taping this right now that wants to stop this name change from happening. Is that reaction concerning to you?
No, it's not, because I think the misnomer there is that people can't call it Pioneer Valley anymore. And that's just not the truth. We want to make the Pioneer Valley great. That's our whole goal. We need to bring in more talented workers. We need to bring in visitors that come to our hotels and our attractions. And Pioneer Valley is not getting it done.
Well, there's a video that goes along with this branding campaign. It uses some descriptors for the region like diversity and ingenuity. It also uses the descriptors fertility and modesty. I'm curious, why modesty and fertility? Why are those adjectives something that this region should be associated with?
And again, this goes into the hour-long presentation and how they viewed us. The modesty factor is, quite honestly, we don't toot our horn enough. We don't realize all the great things that are going on in this region at this point in time. So we are modest about it. And calling it West Mass will hopefully break that barrier down for folks to start tooting their own horns about what goes on here.
What's your feeling? I mean, your initial feeling with that that brand, the look, the name, West Mass?
Well, if I was in a vacuum and I was sitting there and all of a sudden said, we're not going to call the Pioneer Valley anymore, we're going to call it West Mass, I would say that's probably simplified and say, boy, what did they spend $80,000 on that? But that wasn't the process. The process was months long. It was taking an objective look from the outside in as to exactly what's going on here and all the levels of innovation that are happening and all the potential economic impact we would have from a multitude of things that are going on. And the reality is, if you watch that presentation, and I would encourage you to do so, by all means, it makes a lot of sense. It's short. It's simple. It's descriptive geographically. It's in terms of West in Western Mass, if you get into the logos and the marks and the extensions of how it goes into advertising, it makes perfect sense.
I guess, in terms of marketing the region, though, people aren't necessarily going to watch that hour-long presentation if they're looking to come to this area.
Nor do they know it's called the Pioneer Valley currently.
Okay. Well, just given the reception that this campaign has had so far, do you plan to stick with West Mass as a brand?
Absolutely. I mean, the stakeholders that supported this endeavor have embraced it, and our next step moving forward is to start to use it in all of our campaigns. And I think you'll be seeing the logo a lot in businesses just locally.
Okay. Well, Greg Chico, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Greg Chico is a board member of the Greater Springfield Convention and Visitors Bureau. You can watch that video, of course, at nepr.net. More than a million Vietnamese came to the U.S. as refugees in the years after their civil war ended. More than 65,000 Vietnamese make New England home. Now, another massive wave, dislocated Syrians, are seeking safety. It's unclear just how many will be allowed into the U.S. under the Trump administration. These two very different cultures share a common experience. As New England Public Radio's Jill Kaufman reports, through poetry, one Vietnamese refugee who grew up in Hartford is making his experience universal.
It's 1975. Saigon has fallen to the North Vietnamese. The end of the war is the beginning of a global humanitarian crisis. The poet Ocean Vuong and his refugee family arrive in Hartford, Connecticut, 15 years later. He's 2 years old. The first place they stay is in a hotel.
And then we ended up in a one-bedroom apartment. And then we went into a tenement on New Britain Avenue. Then our family separated, and then we started to live with relatives. Then we went to Glastonbury for a short while, East Hartford. Anywhere someone could get a nice place, everyone would just go there.
Vuong is now 28. His poetry has been in The New Yorker more than once. He's published several collections and is a literary voice people are paying attention to.
Like any good son, I pull my father out of the water, drag him by his hair through white sand, his knuckles carving a trail the waves rush in to erase, because the city beyond the shore is no longer where we left it.
Vuong writes about dislocation and about the idea that without political violence, he wouldn't be alive. His mother's father, his grandfather, is an American who fought in Vietnam.
And I think this story, it becomes very integral to me growing up in America, particularly how we think of war in the timeline.
History is slippery. When does war truly end? In Vietnam, in the Middle East.
And when we look at the Syrian crisis, it's strange to me that we call it crisis. Like, what do we expect? You know, and I think part of that is a surprise that comes with the linear timeline. Now it's over, right?
Far from it. In school, the timeline, Vuong says, went like this. Something bad happened in an Asian country. And then, a couple of pages later, it was on to the Gulf War. It was Vuong's grandmother who died in 2008, his mother and her sisters who taught him about the Vietnam War and what life was like before.
You know, my family, they come from a long line of rice farmers. And they just worked on their fields. And a lot of the Vietnamese, even the soldiers who fought, did not know the politics behind what they were doing. And so it was utter chaos.
He began to write down his family's words, songs, and images they described of fields lighting on fire. He wanted to know more.
And so when I asked the next question, why? Why? I would suddenly become the precocious child in the family. You know, and then all of a sudden it's like, stop. We don't want to unravel pain because we have already survived.
Vuong's brother was born in the U.S. He is a typical American teenager, Vuong says. He likes girls, he has a job at Stop and Shop, and he's lived a safer, more stable American childhood than Vuong.
It made me happy to see that ultimately one of us, at least, in the family lived, you know, without fear of displacement, without uncertainty, without navigating through not being able to speak. And for a long time, my family was mute in society.
And there was such shame in being an outsider.
You know, before going to school every morning, my mother would say, be careful, you're already Vietnamese. And I always had this sense that I was a perpetual trespasser, you know, a guest. And in a way, we were.
Despite their turmoil, Vuong says most of his family members are now living very American lives, full of drama and hope, and some version of the American dream. For a brief time, Vuong thought his was to be in corporate America. He became a business major for about 3 weeks. Then, at Manchester Community College in suburban Hartford, he was introduced to literature, philosophy, big ideas. That continued at Brooklyn College. He began to see this inheritance of war in the Greeks, in Homer. It's in the writings of the poet Paul Celan, a Holocaust survivor, who had a major influence on Vuong. And it's in a children's book called Thundercake by Patricia Polacco. He read it when he was 11. Vuong jumps up to get it down from a shelf.
This is so important. This is one of the first books I ever read. You can see it's a very simple book. This is like sort of like my little totem when I'm writing.
It's about a young girl and her Russian grandmother, a survivor of war, and they make a cake with the coming of a storm.
Perhaps Patricia Polacco never dreamed that a Vietnamese boy in Hartford would read her book and see himself. And yet it happened. Storytelling can make this happen, where we can recognize one another.
In college, Vuong read something else that's always stayed with him. It's a 1915 speech by President Woodrow Wilson. He's addressing 3,000 new American citizens in Philadelphia. This is the takeaway for Vuong, read by an actor.
I was born in America. You dreamed dreams of what America was to be, and I hope you brought the dreams with you.
I was just so surprised that here's the President of the United States empowering immigrants, Usually it's always, you know, being talked down to. You know, we're always asked to prove ourselves. But here is the most powerful man in the country saying, here's a blank slate. Write on it what you want. Add your dream.
Vang's American dream, it's simply the possibility of things. He recently bought a little house in Western Massachusetts, where he hopes to bring his mother someday. Vang says it will allow him to grant her American dream, a garden. And he came back because he realized he's a New Englander. He mentions a train ride. He's heading north, looking out the window, seeing the fields, the marshes, the mist rising over them.
And all of a sudden I said, wait a minute, I know that. I never saw that in New York. And that mist was home for me.
Ocean Vong says he never thought he would feel at home in America. For New England Public Radio, I'm Jill Kaufman.
We've posted all the stories from the Facing Change series on our website. That's NEPR.net. Commentator and journalist Shaheen Pasha has a rule in her house. Her kids are never allowed to tell each other to shut up. It's not just a matter of politeness, she says. Shutting people up can be dangerous.
As a child, my Pakistani immigrant mother taught me no one has the right to silence another person. She told me to respect a person's voice, even if you disagree. That lesson, delivered to me at age 4, stuck with me as I became a foreign journalist, reporting from the Middle East. Their rulers and government lackeys silenced the masses. Journalists were told to toe the government line. Stories were killed for calling into question the government's motives or business dealings. If the public lost faith in the government, there would be anarchy, we were scolded, and we would be to blame for the chaos that ensued. We were warned, shut your mouth or face the consequences. I expected that in the autocratic regimes in which I reported. I never thought to hear those words, told to reporters here in the U.S. as we have been by the president's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, who said the media should, and I quote, keep its mouth shut. Journalism is suddenly under siege here, in America. President Trump has announced he is in a running war with the media. We, he said, are among the most dishonest human beings on earth, purveyors of fake news. It's classic. I've heard it all before. It's exactly what leaders around the world say to manipulate the public into losing faith in the press. Every semester, I teach my students that journalists' first obligation is to the truth. When Bannon calls media the opposition party, he's not completely wrong. To be in opposition of anything that's not true is precisely our job. Freedom of press is protected by the Constitution to serve as society's watchdog. In other words, to keep powerful people honest. It can be a thankless job, especially in today's politically divisive environment. But what's the alternative? In countries where the state controls the media, journalists learn to self-censor. Government minders shape the narrative. Human rights violations are swept under the rug. Corruption runs rampant with a handful of elites gaining power and wealth because there is no one to expose them. Rumors abound, stirring up unrest because citizens aren't sure what to believe. As a journalist, I'm not willing to shut up. When you silence the media, you control the message. You control the people. We should all be afraid of that.
Commentator Shaheen Pasha teaches international journalism at UMass Amherst. She lives with her family in Amherst. Thanks for listening to NEPR News Now, stories you really shouldn't miss. This show is produced by listener-funded New England Public Radio. Please give us a rating on iTunes, and while you're there, take a look at the other podcasts from NEPR. We've also got a list at nepr.net/podcasts. You can support those podcasts and all the news and music New England Public Radio delivers to your car, your home, and your phone. Just click the blue Contribute button near the top of the page. Again, thanks for listening. Until next time.